Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. To Smithereens by Rosalind Drexler. The book cover has a wrestling referee holding up the arm of a blonde female wrestler as the winner of the match, while her opponent is lying on the floor at their feet. The reviewer is Lauren Elkin. A brilliantly offbeat novel of art and women's wrestling in 1970s New York. First published in 1972, Rosalind Drexler's To Smithereens throws two vivid subcultures and two unlikely lovers into the ring. One of my favorite Instagram accounts belongs to the Meredith Rosen Gallery. Whoever runs it regularly posts videos of people being daring, random, or exceptionally dumb. A woman in a bikini and a wool hat jumps into a lake that's frozen over. A little kid beats the living daylights out of an inflatable Santa in someone's front yard. The same caption accompanies all of these posts, hashtag art dealing, as if the art world were so absurd as to be a metaphor for every madness, every vanity, and every act of stupid bravery. Something of this zany spirit of juxtaposition governs To Smithereens, Rosalind Drexler's brilliantly offbeat novel of two seemingly unrelated subcultures in 1970s New York City, the art world and women's wrestling. First published in 1972, it begins with a strange man putting his hand on a young woman's thigh in a movie theater. She crushes his fingers, whacks his wrist, and then empties her drink on him. He's into it. They start dating, and he, Paul, a middling art writer, pushes her, Rosa, sans profession but full of beans, to get into professional wrestling. It's his kink, but she's willing to give it a try. Narrated by Paul and Rosa in alternating chapters, To Smithereens is a novel about a man daring a woman to do things and the woman doing them, to test her power, to defy the straitjacket of femininity, and to grow ever larger and stronger. Paul tries to give Rosa an artistic education, but she sees art in a fundamentally different way. When he shows her a picture of Marguerite's The Listening Room, a painting of a fat apple as big as the room it was in, as Rosa puts it, she disagrees with his take that the apple is aggressive or crowding out the room. An apple is natural. It belongs wherever it is, on trees, on the ground, in bowls, in rooms. Marguerite was on the side of the apple, I'm sure. His rooms are always being invaded or made to hold the outdoors in. He must have read Alice in Wonderland. His objects have done what the label on the bottle or the message on the table told them to. Drink me, eat me. And like Alice, they threaten to come through the roof. I'm an apple. I'm Alice. I'm Rosa. Paul is a hilarious send-up of a self-serious art writer who considers it his role to help clarify. As he attends a circuit of parties, exhibition openings, and 60s-style happenings, including one in which he receives a sexual favor on a mausoleum, he is mindful that he must make his mark by inventing some catchphrase that will cement his importance. I had been straining to coin a new word for the new art, a word as strong as pop, op, or minimal. A few times I had entered the phrase stop art to express my feeling that art was coming to an end because it has no place to go, but it was not picked up. Nobody wanted to stop anything. Everybody wanted to start something, to be the first, not the last. Drexler's portrayal of the pro wrestling scene is no less vivid. In language as deft and muscular as Rosa's team, Drexler captures the scent of the blood and the resin, every wisecrack and sob story, every flake of talc and gob of spit, every pimple and blackhead on the lady wrestler's thighs. As Rosa tries to memorize a sequence of moves before her first fight, language hits the mat in deference to the found poetry of the ring. Monkey flip, kick out keister bumps, baby face, waist scissors, heel whip kick out, hot flying mare, cool figure four murder. The promoters call her Rosario, the Mexican sizzling spitfire, though she's a Jewish American girl who's never been south of the border. Off she goes on tour with a colorful cast of women wrestlers and their assorted hangers-on. Jean Burley, the greatest, most beautiful athlete in America, Canada, and Mexico, according to her manager, Bobby Fox. Tommy J. Jukes, I'm purdy, but I'm dirty. And Mike, the promoter, and his right-hand man, Shorty, a person with dwarfism who comes in for page after page of ableist invective. I know, it's 1972, but yikes. Drexler's own biography lends the novel an irrefutable air of authenticity. Now approaching 100, she was a collage artist and fixture of the 1960s pop art scene, who has not only managed to produce 10 plays and 9 novels, but herself had a spell as a wrestler. Her nom de guerre was Rosa Carlo, and Andy Warhol once made a silkscreen print of her in her leotard, crouched as if preparing to attack. Like a collage or a fight, To Smithereens is at its heart about relationships and the conflict and contact that is their lifeblood, or their ruin. Toward the end of the novel, as Rosa and Paul try to make a go of cohabitating, Paul quotes Kafka's diary, "The hardships of living together, forced upon us by strangeness, pity, lust, cowardice, vanity, and only deep down, perhaps, a thin little stream worthy of the name love, impossible to seek out, flashing once in the moment of a moment." It's an apt description of his life with Rosa, he thinks. Two contenders, no one to rescue us from ourselves, each other's victims. The reviewer, Lauren Elkin, is the author most recently of the novel Scaffolding. The Book of Records by Madeline Tien. The book cover has a full moon peeking over many rows of blue waves drawn by the flat side of a chalk. A small white figure is embedded in the waves. The reviewer is Lauren LeBlanc. A father and daughter caught in the no-man's land of migration. Madeline Tien's time-warping historical novel, The Book of Records, collapses centuries and geographies in an ambitious family saga. In 1971, decades after her exile from Europe, the German-born political theorist Hannah Arendt wrote to her friend, the novelist Mary McCarthy, "One can't say how life is, how chance or fate deals with people, except by telling the tale." The generative power of storytelling inspires Madeline Tien's deeply humane novel, The Book of Records. In an aching, dreamlike narrative that overlaps distant centuries and geographies to chart cycles of authoritarianism and loss, Tien uncovers glimmers of community among disparate individuals. The bittersweet novel opens on the banks of the sea, an abandoned military outpost turned no man's land, where people who needed to disappear or who had no other nation began to take refuge centuries ago. For most people, including 7-year-old Lena and her father Wui, the sea was just one stop on the way to a better place. Its location is uncertain, a site of imagination and conjecture. Though Lena and Wui believe they're in the South China Sea, other inhabitants say it's the Atlantic or the Baltic. They've left behind their home and Lena's mother, brother, and aunt in Foshan, China, without explanation beyond Wui's desire to flee an empire in ruins, he says, a hall of mirrors in which good people could betray themselves and never know it. But Lena's loneliness and confusion clash with her father's brave front. For them, this is no temporary way station, Wui suffering from an illness that makes the sea a final destination. Adrift, Lena seeks solace in a rare commodity, books. The only three her father hastily packed, taken from a 90-volume series for children called The Great Lives of Voyagers, chronicle the lives of the philosopher Baruch Spinoza, the poet Dufu, and Arendt herself. For Lena, these blue-covered books were a net that would suspend us outside the present, we embellishing his reading with episodes not in the text. As she grows, she realizes his trick, that he made things up and thereby slowed time down, ensuring that no matter how long our journey lasted, we'd never run out of history, no matter how true or inaccurate it was. When they're not reading, the two find kinship with three neighbors whose ethereal and unlikely presences raise the question of whether they exist at all. Inexplicably, each shares uncanny similarities with the three historical figures in Lena's books, and together they expand upon her simple children's stories to weave absorbing, evocative tales about the non-fictional voyagers. These spellbinding historical passages serve as a ballast to Lena and Wui's uncertain existence. Although Tian could have written a purely historical novel, she gracefully folds these mostly true stories into an ambitious family saga, like accordion pleats. With her imagined worlds, incandescent prose, and malleable sense of time and history, Tian strikes worthy comparisons to Italo Calvino, Walter Benjamin, Gaston Bachelard, and Ali Smith's Seasonal Quartet. This staggering novel blurs the line between fact and fiction to underscore the importance of storytelling itself as a practice of endurance and resistance. Years pass, and Lena is fixed in place as the sole caretaker of her still ailing father, watching ships filled with refugees come and go without any sign of her family. Trapped in a place where time never goes missing, Lena latches into these philosophical conversations and stories as her education, as the only movement she knows. When a middle section discloses the truth behind Wui's flight from home, the book of records then toggles in time to reconcile the brutality of betrayal with the forgiveness inherent in unconditional love. Try to read without weeping profusely. The reviewer, Lauren LeBlanc, is a writer and board member of the National Book Critics Circle. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, and The Believer, among other publications. Original Sin: President Biden's Decline and Its Cover-Up and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again, by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson. The reviewer is Jennifer Zelai. A damning portrait of an enfeebled Biden protected by his inner circle. Original Sin, by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson, depicts an aging president whose family and aides enabled his quixotic campaign for a second term. There is a photo of President Biden in profile, standing at a podium, speaking in front of a microphone. The caption reads, "President Joe Biden delivering a foreign policy address in Washington, D.C. on January 13, 2025. In Christian theology, original sin begins with Adam and Eve eating the forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge. But Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson's Original Sin chronicles a different fall from grace. The cover image is a black-and-white portrait of Joe Biden with a pair of hands clamped over his eyes. The biblical story is about the danger of innocent curiosity. The story in this new book is about the danger of willful ignorance. The original sin of election 2024 was Biden's decision to run for re-election, followed by aggressive efforts to hide his cognitive diminishment," Tapper and Thompson write. On the evening of June 27, 2024, Democratic voters watched the first presidential debate in amazement and horror. A red-faced Donald Trump let loose a barrage of audacious whoppers while Biden, slack-jawed and pale, struggled to string together intelligible rebuttals. Trump's debate performance was of a piece with his rallies, a jumble of nonsensical digressions and wild claims. But for many Americans, the extent of Biden's frailty came as a shock. Most of the president's appearances had, by then, become tightly controlled affairs. For at least a year and a half, Biden's aides had been scrambling to accommodate an octogenarian president who was becoming increasingly exhausted and confused. According to Original Sin, which makes pointed use of the word cover-up in the subtitle, alarmed donors and polls who sought the lowdown on Biden's cognitive state were kept in the dark. Others had daily evidence of Biden's decline, but didn't want to believe it. Tapper is an anchor for CNN and also served as a moderator for the presidential debate. Thompson is a national political correspondent for Axios. In an author's note, they explained that they interviewed approximately 200 people, including high-level insiders, some of whom may never acknowledge speaking to us, but all of whom know the truth within these pages. The result is a damning step-by-step account of how the people closest to a stubborn, aging president enabled his quixotic resolve to run for a second term. The authors traced the deluge of trouble that flowed from Biden's original sin, the sidelining of Vice President Kamala Harris, the attacks on journalists like Thompson, who deigned to report on worries about Biden's apparent fatigue and mental state, an American public lacking clear communication from the president and left to twist in the wind. It was an abomination, one source told the authors. He stole an election from the Democratic Party. He stole it from the American people. This blistering charge is attributed to a, quote, a prominent Democratic strategist, unquote, who also, quote, publicly defended Biden, unquote. In Original Sin, the reasons given for saying nice things in public about the president are legion. Some Democrats, especially those who didn't see the president that often, relied on his surrogates for reassurance about his condition. He's fine, he's fine, he's fine. Others were wary of giving ammunition to the Trump campaign, warning that he was an existential threat to the country. Tapper and Thompson are scornful of such rationales. For those who try to justify the behavior described here because of the threat of the second Trump term, those fears should have shocked them into reality, not away from it. Biden announced that he would be running for re-election in April 2023. He had turned 80 the previous November and was already the oldest president in history. Over his long life, he had been through a lot: the death of his wife and daughter in a car accident in 1972, two aneurysm surgeries in 1988, the death of his son Beau in 2015, and the seemingly endless trouble kicked up by his son Hunter, a recovering addict whose legal troubles included being under investigation by the Justice Department. Yet Biden always bounced back. The fact that he defied the naysayers and beat the odds to win the 2020 election was, for him and his close circle of family and advisors, a sign that he was special and persistently underestimated. They maintained a near-religious faith of Biden's ability to rise again, the authors write, and as with any theology, skepticism was forbidden. In 2019, when Biden announced a presidential run, he was 76. It was still a time when good Biden was far more present than old Biden. By 2023, the authors suggest, that ratio had reversed. Some of his decline was hard to distinguish from what they call the Biden-ness, which included his long-time reputation for gaffes, meandering stories, and a habit of forgetting staffers' names. But people who didn't see Biden on a daily basis were increasingly taken aback when they finally laid eyes on him. They would remark on how his once booming voice had become a whisper, how his confident stride had become a shuffle. An aghast congressman recalls being reminded of his father, who had Alzheimer's. Another thought of his father, too, who died of Parkinson's. The people closest to Biden landed on some techniques to handle or disguise what was happening: restricting urgent business to the hours between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., instructing his writers to keep his speeches brief so that he didn't have to spend too much time on his feet, having him use the short stairs to Air Force One. When making videos, his aide sometimes filmed in slow motion to blur the reality of how slowly he actually walked. By late 2023, his staff was pushing as much of his schedule as they could to midday. When White House aides weren't practicing fastidious stage management, they seemed to be sticking their heads in the sand. According to a forthcoming book by Josh Dossey, Tyler Pager, and Isaac Arnsdorf, Biden's aides decided against his taking a cognitive test in early 2024. Tapper and Thompson quote a physician who served as a consultant to the White House medical unit for the last four administrations and expressed his dismay at the idea of withholding such information. If there's no diagnosis, there's nothing to disclose. Just how much of this rigmarole was desperate rationalization versus deliberate scheming is never entirely clear. Tapper and Thompson identify two main groups that closed ranks around Biden: his family and a group of close aides known internally as the Politburo that included his longtime strategist Mike Donilon and his counselor Steve Ricchetti. The family encouraged Biden's view of himself as a historic figure. The Politburo was too politically hard-nosed for that. Instead, its members pointed to Biden's record in office and the competent people around him. The napping, the whispering, the shuffling, all that stuff had merely to do with the performative parts of the job. Tapper and Thompson vehemently disagree. They offer a gracious portrait of Robert Hur, the special counsel who investigated Biden's handling of classified materials, and in his February 2024 report, famously described the president as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. Biden and his team were incensed and tried to slime Hur as an unprofessional right-wing hack, but the authors defend his notorious line. They emphasize that it is incumbent upon a special counsel to spell out how the subject of an investigation would probably appear to a jury, and that what Hur wrote about Biden was true. Of course, in an election like 2024, when the differences between the candidates are so stark and the stakes are so high, nearly every scrap of information gets viewed through the lens of, will it help my team win? Even competently administered policy could not compensate for a woeful inability to communicate with the American people. In a democracy, this is a tragedy, especially if you believe, as Biden did, that a second Trump term would put the very existence of that democracy in peril. Earlier this month, in what looks like an attempt to get ahead of the book's publication, Biden went on The View to say that he accepts some responsibility for Trump's victory. I was in charge. But he was dismissive about reports of any cognitive decline. In Original Sin, Tapper and Thompson describe him waking up the morning after the 2024 election, thinking that if only he had stayed in the race, he would have won. That's what the polls suggest, he would say again and again. The authors write, there was just one problem with his reasoning. His pollsters told us that no such polls existed. The reviewer, Jennifer Zelai, is the nonfiction book critic for the New York Times. The Marble Hall Murders by Anthony Horowitz. The book cover is red, with an eyedrop bottle filled three-quarters of the way with black ink. The eyedropper has a quill-tip pen at the end of it. The reviewer is Sarah Lyle. Horowitz's diabolically clever Marble Hall Murders, published by Harper, begins as Susan Ryland, a British book editor, starts reading the newest installment in a crime series featuring a Poirot-like detective named Atticus Punt. The book looks promising. The plot is enticing. The writing sharp. The detective as canny as ever. But Susan soon realizes that what she's reading isn't just a cheerful murder mystery bringing back a much-loved character, as she puts it, but rather a bubbling cauldron of hatred, infidelity, greed, and murder drawn from the troubled past of the writer Elliot Grace. Elliot, who has been hired to continue the series following the untimely death of the original author, is squirrely, pugnacious, and keen to make trouble. "I've put in a secret message," he says of his work in progress. "If you can work out the puzzle, you'll know the truth about what happened." That's only the beginning of Horowitz's multi-level romp, which serves up an elegant plot while lampooning writers, publishers, murderers, rich people, and Golden Age mystery stories. It's a cliche to describe prolific authors as being at the top of their game, and often seems to suggest the opposite. But it's true here. Marble Hall Murders is as cunning a mystery as you'll read all year. The best thing is Susan herself. Stubborn and fearless, she has high literary standards, a fondness for Garamond typeface, and a dangerous habit of collecting enemies. The reviewer, Sarah Lyle, is a writer at large for the New York Times, meaning that she's not assigned to a single department, but covers a range of topics. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.